Good evening, everybody. Someone commented to me just before what an amazing mark of dedication it is to see so many teachers and educators in a space this particular evening, which for so many of you is in fact the first day of the school holidays. It's absolutely terrific to see you. My name's Annette Rome, and with Jerry White, who's in the front row there, we are co-presidents of the Melbourne Regional Group for the Australian College of Educators. And the Melbourne Regional Group works as one of the regional groups under the auspices of the Victorian State Committee. So I welcome you on behalf of the Australian College of Educators. I also welcome you on behalf of Wesley College, and we'll just ignore the little noises to my left here, and also on behalf of the Wesley College Institute. 2009 will provide, we hope, a very interesting program of offerings for Australian College of Educators members. I know a number of you that are here tonight are ACE members. I will also say if you're not an ACE member, there is the opportunity to join this evening, and registration cards are up with Carolyn Woodhouse, who's sitting down the back there. I'd like to formally welcome also a number of, I think, very key people in education to this evening's lecture. I know we have principals and deputy principals and leaders of different regional educational groups in the room tonight, including some ex-bosses of mine. I welcome you all very warmly. So I'm now going to hand over to Jerry White, who is going to introduce our guest this evening. Thanks, Jerry.
Well, thanks, Annette. And good evening, folks. Carl Stevens, College Fellows, ladies and gentlemen. The gentleman on my left is a Canadian. That's firstly a good sign. He doesn't come from the neighbourhood to the south. He comes from the neighbourhood in the north. But what annoys me about Stephen, I have to tell you right up front, I've got to get this off my chest, is that Stephen makes very complex concepts very simple. I just wish I could do it, but he does it. Stephen is a senior researcher at the National Council of Research in Canada. His background is in philosophy. He's a philosopher and a researcher. He's an avid science fiction reader and a magnificent photographer. Look, I think that's the greatest skill that he actually has, so you're probably here under false pretenses anyway. He's a total and complete subversive. That means he's a good educator. And he's a brilliant tinkerer and thinker. I've known Stephen since about 1999, but I only first met him physically in, 2004. But we've shared our minds together over a number of discussions and so on, and I avidly follow his photographs, because wherever he has been, you've got to watch his photographs in case you're taken and you don't want to be taken. That's the reason why I really watch them, Stephen, but on a more serious note, they're very, very good. Education is going through a rethink in the Western world. There's no doubt about that. And there are a lot of philosophers and educational researchers and so on that have talked about what's actually happening, what young people are doing as a result of the use of digital learning in school, digital technologies, digital literacy. But I would say at the moment that what is the changes that are going to be wrought in education really haven't seriously begun. Young people think quite differently to the way that I was raised in the print literacy tradition. And young people I talk about at the moment, many of whom were born in the year, let's go back, if they were born in 1995, when the whole of the World Wide Web was introduced and came into Australia with the force, even though it was invented in 1989 in Switzerland and CERN, if they were born in 1995, here we are in 2009, and they're teenagers. They don't question it. They want to know when it works, and if it doesn't, they'll go and find a place where it does work. We need to give this pretty serious thought if we're going to educate people, our young people, into the future, particularly in our schools, TAFE colleges and universities. One of the people in the world, the foremost thinker in this area, the foremost researcher, is my colleague Stephen Downes. Ladies and gentlemen, Stephen Downes.
Thanks a lot, and pleasure to be here. And I came here thinking this was going to be informal, all with the wine and the bat. And, how are we doing?
Working.
And I'm here to show you.
Okay, excellent. Oh, stop. Okay, now can we have the screen? sorry. He's been working really hard on this. When he sees this, he's going to be like, he should have been there. Never mind. Excellent. All right. I'm just about to use that. So, this is my first visit to Melbourne since 2001. In 2001, I came out here for 3 months on a fellowship at the University of Melbourne, and I was working with Tim Van Gelder, who's a philosopher. But my major accomplishment here in Melbourne in 2001 was this video. So I'm going to begin by showing you this video.
I'm Steve Down, and I'm here to show you some interesting lessons we've learned about adult education theories, and especially self-directed learning. Yes, we've learned about self-directed learning not through the study of humans, but through the study of the ultimate self-directed learners, ants. So we see the ants going through the maze. What you want to notice is the ants are going in the proper direction through the maze. They're not going off down side streets. They're not getting stuck in dead ends. They're going in the one end and back out the other end without making a mistake. Now, this is not natural behavior for ants. Ants do not want to go through a maze. Ants simply want to go in a straight line. The whole trick here is to force them to go in curves and even back against the direction of their travel. Here we see the ants navigating around the corner against their natural instincts. How did we train them to do this? We used simple principles of self-directed learning. First of all, we started off with where the ants want to go anyway, where they are and where they're going. They were traveling in a straight line. Then we made small incremental changes to their direction. We drew a line across their path. The ants went around the line. Then we drew another line across their path. Then they went around the line and back up around the line. And we kept drawing lines until we had constructed a maze, forcing them to twist and turn against their natural grain. Now, ants are like self-directed learners. They like to cut the corners. If you give them an opportunity, they will go over the line rather than around it. You have to be consistent and firm in your direction, making incremental changes, and always reinforcing your lesson by building up the wall that directs the ants to where you want them to go.
Don't do this at home. This man is a trained professional.
This is so dangerous. Working with ants is difficult, but stay tuned next time when we work with cats.
Okay, you can kill the sound. I hope all that work was worth it. That video was a month in production. I came down here to work with Tim Van Gelder, and what he was doing is something that was still pretty new in 2001. He was putting philosophy courses online, so I came down here to help him. And actually, the thing that I took from Melbourne wasn't this video. It was the concept that I worked on at that time called the Learning Marketplace. And the idea of the Learning Marketplace, and this is something that by now is fairly familiar to people, and indeed was even fairly familiar to people back then. The idea of the Learning Marketplace is a marketplace where you can access learning materials, whether you're a student, an individual student, a college, university, etc. The idea was that you could go online, you could search for the materials, you could get these materials, plug them into your learning management system, and all of the rest of it. And so I came back home in 2001. I was very confident that this learning marketplace was the way to go, and I began to set up learning marketplaces. I began to write about things like content syndication and RSS, ways of sending learning content from one place to another automatically, ways of streaming it, organizing it by subject, creating subscriptions that people could sign up for, and all of that. And the learning industry as well, at that time, began to adopt this sort of approach. By the time 2001 rolled around, the concept of learning objects was well known and being widely used. The idea of a learning object was that it was a piece of digital content that could be reused to support online learning. There's an official IEEE definition, any digital content. I forget exactly what it is, but digital content that can be reused for the purpose of learning is basically what it is. And there was a lot of work done around this concept. IEEE, as I just mentioned, created a learning object metadata standard. Other standards were developed by IMS, the Instructional Management System in the United States, for learning design, content packaging, and all the rest. And time went by, and what I noticed happening was that the concept was drifting further and further and further away from what I thought I was working on back in 2001 when I created the Learning Marketplace. I was trying to figure out for myself what had gone wrong. Where did this go off the rails? And I came back to Australia, and this is when I met Jerry for the first time, and came back to Australia and actually did a tour. It was a wonderful tour. I went up the coast, all the way up to Cairns, and over to Darwin, and then down to Adelaide, where I met with Edna, education.au, and then to Tasmania, all the way up to Perth. And as I went through this tour, I was working on the concept of the learning marketplace, but I was also working on the concept of content syndication and online learning and trying to grapple with this. Now, work had been done here in Australia. Work had been done by Edna and by the Learning Federation. There was a marketplace of learning resources being developed, even things that persist to this day, such as the toolboxes that come out of the Flexible Learning Framework. That sort of thing had started. And what had happened, I concluded, is that learning somewhere in those years became a thing. And it's almost, sometimes, you know, when I'm really being snarky, I don't know if any of you are publishers, but when I'm really being snarky, what I say is the publishers got a hold of the concepts and they turned it into something that they recognize and, well, cynically, that they can sell. And the idea was that online learning, instead of this wonderful, distributed, syndicated, free-flowing thing that we had in mind now, the learning objects, that they became objects, static, like books. And creating learning resources was like publishing learning resources, and content packaging even was like, well, packaging learning resources. And the networks that they built, we, because I was actually implicated in some of these projects, not willingly, but nonetheless. I did a lot of kicking and screaming in those days. But the networks that were built weren't even proper syndication networks. They were what are called federations. And the type of search that was conducted on those networks was federated search. And it was all very closed, and it was all very contained, and it was all very, well, commercial, and it wasn't learning. It was a content production enterprise. And as I'm going around Australia, and I'm going around and I'm talking to teachers, I'm going from conference to conference, I'm just working through this concept, I realized, and the first realization happened out in Queensland, the Sunshine Coast. And when I was there, I was at a farm out in the Sunshine Coast, and it wasn't on the coast, obviously. It was inland, there's hills, there's palm trees, it's beautiful, you know. And so I'm standing in this backyard, and there's a field, and there's this palm tree by itself, and there's this horse. And I realize, wait a second here, that is more like the model of online learning that I have in mind. The palm tree and the horse. You might think, well, okay, I've become crazy now. But no, that's not what I mean. Because The way learning was set up before, it was structured, it was organized, it was chapter one, chapter two, chapter three, it was linear, it was like a book. But really, when we're talking about learning as it can be done online, when we're talking about learning using new learning technologies, it doesn't need to be, and probably shouldn't be, neatly structured and organized like a book. Now, the first iteration of that is content as hypertext. And you're all familiar with the idea of content as hypertext. Content as hypertext no longer is linear. You can move from one page to another simply by following the hypertext. But in the world of computer science, you can take that even a step further. I grew up in a thing called a MUD. My mother was not thrilled by this, and my younger brothers were told to stay away from the creek, but totally a different story. The word MUD stands for multi-user dungeon. A multi-user dungeon is an online game, a lot like World of Warcraft or EVE Online, or the ones that they're playing today. This was back in the days of text-based. It was almost before computers. My age is showing, right? But the thing is, what a MUD was, it was an entirely object-oriented environment. Now, what that meant was, the way the computer program was set up is the MUD was a great big object. And it had properties, and it had functions. So if you started up this MUD and sent it a message, rain, for example, it would start raining inside the MUD. Now, what does that mean? What that means is, inside the big object, you have smaller little objects. And these little objects can do things. You can have little rain objects, you can have room objects, you can have monster objects, you can have player objects. And the idea is that these objects send messages back and forth, and they interact with each other. Now, this is a model of content that is completely different from a model of content that is structured like a book with chapters and so on. It's a model of content where you have a horse and a palm tree. And the horse isn't designed for the palm tree, and the palm tree isn't designed for the horse, but the horse can interact with the palm tree, and the palm tree, under certain very rare circumstances, can interact with the horse. Right? And that's what learning online is. Learning online is an environment, not a content structure. So that's Queensland. And I go up to Darwin, and then I go to Alice Springs and Uluru, and down in the Harang, charging the people of Edna. I get up to Tasmania, and to Strong in particular, and I wish I could remember the guy's name off the top of my head, but in Strong, there's a wharf, and there's a building, and there's a slogan on the building which says, essentially, we are not owners or managers of this land, we are but stewards. And if you go to Strong, you'll probably see it. That's not the exact quote, but that's essentially the idea. And so I'm looking at that, I'm standing there waiting for my bus to take me back to go to Hobart again and talk about economic development and other neat stuff, and I'm realizing the other half of what has gone wrong with learning resources. And what has gone wrong with learning resources is that learning, online learning, is being treated as something that is organized and managed and done for people, very much the way people were organizing and managing environments. But in fact, learning online is more like an ecology, where the pieces fit together, where they interact with each other, where these pieces are students, where these pieces are contents, and you can't manage that. You can only be a steward of it. So I came back from Australia with all of that. And so that's what Australia has contributed to my own theory of learning, my own thinking about online learning. And since then, the approach that I've taken, and I think it's an important, of course I would, wouldn't I? An important approach is the idea of learning, online learning, not as content, but as network. The idea of learning itself, not as the acquisition of content, not as the placing of facts and knowledge and sentences and propositions into a brain, but rather personal growth, personal development, internal ecology, if you will, and external ecology. And this is the sort of thing that I've been working on and attempting to develop since. And it gives us a picture of learning, a picture of education that is very different from the picture that we have today. It gives us a picture where instead of setting up institutions that organize and manage learning for people, rather we create environments and we populate these environments with resources, learning resources and other resources. And we set people, well, free in these learning environments. And learning consists of participating and interacting in these environments. You might say, well, what characterizes these environments? These environments are what might be called, and I really hate starting to use jargon like this, but what might be called authentic communities of practice. What that means is the environment in which learning occurs is the environment in which professional activities occur. Learning occurring in an environment of a forest is the same environment that silviculture takes place. People learning to study law learn that in a courtroom. And the idea here is that they are participating in this community of inquiry. They are interacting with resources, with conversations, with vocabularies composed of these online learning resources. And so I think that, and I'm wrapping up because Jerry told me this was a relatively short talk. Is that about right? Okay. What I think we're leading to in the future is a change. How do I want to phrase it? A scroll down here, but I know what I want to say. A change in describing education from a system where we describe it in terms of causes, where we describe it in terms of generalizations, where we describe knowing in terms of categoricals and propositions, to the idea of a distributed, I'm trying to read my writing here and it's not working. The idea of knowledge as distributed, the idea of knowledge as emergent, the idea of knowledge as ineffable. Sorry, we'll come back to that if that was really horribly mangled. The idea here is that when structuring learning, when building these networks of learning, what we're trying to do is build networks that produce reliable and effective knowledge. So the structure of our learning networks is the structure of a network that will, first of all, foster communication so that it's possible to communicate, but also regulate communication so that it doesn't run away with itself. And I'm kind of eliding a longer discussion here. So the idea here is that the networks are composed of entities that are diverse, composed of entities that are autonomous, that are making their own decisions. The networks themselves are open so that communication can take place, so that members of these networks can send messages from one to the other freely, and are structured in such a way that the knowledge that is produced by these networks is not produced by any individual in the network, but rather the network as a whole. And I think I'll stop on that note and let Jerry
so
continue.
Stephen's saying to us, hang on a second, you're actually saying to us that our mode of classroom hierarchical education is not going to take us into the future.
Correct.
You're saying it's going flat, it's going to be distributed, and knowledge will be built by the interaction in networks.
Exactly.
You're joking, aren't you?
No, I'm not joking. Well, here, right off the bat, okay, the reason why I think that a hierarchical, and by hierarchical what I mean is structure-based, rule-based, principle-based type of knowledge or organization can't work, is that our society, our information environment has become too complex for that to work. It's not possible to simply manage learning and manage development anymore. Think of the idea of, you know, your classic example of managed education, something like a common core curriculum or something like that. But what would count as a common core curriculum, particularly when we think about a global environment these days, right? There's so many things that need to be doing that if we're focusing everybody on a common core curriculum, we're making it harder and harder for us to address the very difficult knowledge, the very difficult learning that happens at the edges. So we need to devolve from this idea that there's a common principle that would describe what an education should be for everyone. And we need to move into a system, you know, I don't want to say personalized education because it sounds like we're creating little personalized education, but an education that's more personal, that is more appropriate for an individual, their capacities, needs, and interests, wherever they are. And you can't manage something that complex. You can't organize it. The only way to create an educational system that is able to adapt to these individual needs is to create structures where these individual needs are described and satisfied by the individuals themselves, or in short form, instead of providing an education for people, which is what we do with our hierarchical system, we have to set up a mechanism whereby people can provide an education for themselves.
But we've got national curriculum, we've got tests in year 3, 5, 7 or 9, and we're going pretty well. What do you think? Hey, you can't be right. Oh, we've got classrooms, we've got national curriculum, we've got tests. Come on, we've hit the nail on the head, haven't we? Whereas Stephen's saying it's distributed, there's an interaction between people, and that's when Eddie and Wenger says that too. So when people interact on the networks, their learning actually occurs.
Yeah, and he goes further, he says that this is what characterizes a discipline, a community of inquiry itself. Right? And he's not the only one. Thomas Kuhn talks about science in the same sort of language, that science consists of this interaction between people. And what constitutes knowledge in this discipline isn't, again, a set of facts that you can just simply pass on to people, but actually the language, even the mannerisms in some cases, the standards of evidence, the standards of proof, and this varies from community to community across different disciplines.
So can we have a set of anythings? I mean, okay, it might not be a set of facts, but is it a set of concepts? Is it a set of skills? Is it a set of attitudes? I mean, you know, the work on the national curriculum isn't just focused on facts, but it's trying to find something as a starting point for learning. Or are you advocating chaos? What? You know, we're trying to see where you are. At least I'm trying to see where you are.
Well, I mean, the opposite of management is not chaos. Okay? And this is something that's very important to keep in mind. It's very often depicted that way, right? Without somebody in charge, nobody's in charge, and everything goes crazy. But, and this is the part that I was stumbling over earlier, these network structures that I described self-organize. So even though nobody is managing a network of interconnected people, or a network of interconnected neurons for that matter, it nonetheless organizes itself. Think about your head. There is no head neuron. And in fact, that would be dangerously bad if there was a head neuron in your head. So similarly in society, there isn't, well, I shouldn't say in society, because of course, you know, right now there are managers. That's not necessarily a good thing. But what I'm trying to say here is that instead of trying to organize and find some sort of common facts, common processes, common skills, whatever, even that enterprise itself is in, to a certain degree, misguided. Now, that does not mean that within communities there aren't these things, but these things are found within the communities. It's, you can't just sort of grab them from the communities and put them up and say, here they are, you know, here's the sentences, here's the skills, because they are distributed, because they are ineffable, you know, because they are emergent. They're not the sort of things that, that can actually be contained in a single object. Does that make sense? You can say no, it's okay.
Just here, and then steps down the front.
It's not the most coherent thing.
I understand the concerns about the, from the education department and all that, but as, and that's something that needs to be dealt with, but as well as people who, I presume everyone in this room was born after 1995, as people who are trained in this more conventional learning style, how do we, what skills do we need to have to be able to do this? Because I know for myself, I don't think that way. I may agree with you that that's what needs to happen, but I don't know how to change the way my brain works so I can behave that way.
Sure. I tend to characterize this in terms of three major principles, keeping in mind that I'm not describing reality when I describe these principles, just a way of slicing and dicing. And these principles are interaction, usability, and relevance. By interaction, what I mean is making interaction a regular and constant part of your life, using the tools that are now available to be connected with more people, and when we come back to these network principles, more diverse people, autonomous people, and not just your crowd of friends, but to connect with people openly from around the world. And that, that becomes a priority. The idea here is that, again, you're not trying to get a set of facts from people, you're trying to plug yourself into a flow of information, a flow of interactivity. Douglas Rushkoff talks about surfing this flow of information, and it's very much that same sort of skill. And so the idea here is just learning how to go with that informational flow and learning how to predict where it's going, learning how to understand where it's going. The second part is usability. Usability breaks down into consistency and simplicity, and what that means for you as a person who's managing your own professional development is to actually take an active role in organizing your own learning, to organize it in such a way that it's consistent with your own beliefs, your own set of values, to organize it in such a way that it's simple and accessible, to, for example, rework what you've read elsewhere, to represent theories that you've read from other people in your own terms, or to see them from your own perspective, your own frame, and then to actually create, I don't want to say a search engine because Google has done that, but to create some sort of artifact, some sort of archive, some sort of representation of your own knowledge and your own beliefs that you can easily and consistently refer back to. And then the third part is salience or relevance. And what this is to take control over the sources of information that are coming to you and to take control over when and where this information is coming to you. So instead of depending on, as they say, the usual channels for information, your employer, your school, if you're in a school, newspapers, radio, to actually get information from as wide and diverse set of resources as possible, and to bring that information in. I talk about subscribing to RSS feeds, using a feed reader, for example, and subscribing to blogs or subscribing to instant message feeds and all of that, and bringing this content into you, and then using multiple devices as appropriate for your own life and your own style of learning. So having this information on your own computer, having these feeds on your BlackBerry or your mobile phone, in other words, making sure you have this information where you want it. Real simple things, like I needed to go downtown to the city to pick up something for my wife today, so I just simply accessed Google Maps and I looked it up. I mean, that's the information I needed when I needed it. It's that sort of thing. Setting up your information environment so this kind of thing is available to you when you need it.
I understand completely what you're talking about because I've immersed myself in a network like this, and and so all of you, everything you're saying makes total sense to me. And I can understand that there's probably people here who it makes no sense to whatsoever, because I think you need that immersion factor to really start to understand it. So my question is, it's the transfer that I think is going to be the difficult part, and I think the transfer needs to occur first to the teachers. I think teachers need to understand how this stuff works before they can transfer it to their students. And I think that's from my experience, is that, you know, I've immersed myself for probably a year and a half now, and now I'm starting to do the transfer into the student population who I teach to try to see how I can get that happening there. But how do you see how that transfer is going to occur in a scaled-up version? Because that's the issue.
Well, and this points to the contradiction of actually an event like this, where I simply tell you about it, right? Because, you know, when I simply tell people about it, it's pretty much unbelievable. And you're quite right. You have to immerse yourself in it. And from the point of view of a practitioner, from the point of view of somebody who's already using, you know, these network techniques, I think that really the only effective way of transferring them is to model them and to demonstrate them. To actually use these information flows yourself. You know, I've been using them for many years. I've been using RSS feeds. I've been using other sources of information. And what these things have done for me over these years have given me a capacity to have more and more of an insight into my own discipline. Now, people may argue that this insight is incomplete or inaccurate, but I think that's true of any insight into any discipline. But the point is, it's given me this capacity, this ability that I haven't had. And instead of just going up and telling people, do this, do this, do this, what I've tried to do with my work is to actually show how I get this information, show how I do tap into RSS feeds, Twitter feeds, and the rest of it, and immerse myself into the network, and then let people make their own decision. Let them look at what I've been able to learn and to accomplish working in this way, and then decide, is this a reliable method? And the evidence thus far is people who have been watching myself and other people like myself do this are generally concluding that, yes, this method is working for them, just based on the results. And I really think that's the only way that you can do it.
Over here, and then back to Graham.
I guess people of our generation are pretty literate, and they use the RSS feed, and I do myself, to great effect, I think, to make ourselves more informed. But I think there's a difference between information gathering and knowledge building. The research we've done at Wesley with students here on e-readers and e-texts showed us that students actually have a great deal of difficulty reading on the screen, really reading. And watching my own daughters who are really skilled, they use the online world for a lot of communication, but not a great deal of knowledge making. I think they do information exchange, but they don't take it to any next step. And I'm just wondering whether this information environment's really great for literate people like us, who've been through the process of becoming deep readers, but I'm not so sure I'd be able to suggest that on the basis of our research, that our students are deep readers of the screen. They are scanners, they skim, and a lot of the time, having it on the screen is enough without really engaging it. So I'm just wondering if the paradigms that we're in actually apply to the younger students.
Yeah, and there's a sense in which they do and there's a sense in which they don't, right? There's a sense in which they do in the sense that, how do I want to put this? We want them to be deep thinkers. And really, although the technology now is such that it's hard to read online, we're in a transition point. We're moving from, you know, really bad screens to screens that are more and more easy to read from. And so, I've seen Kindle screens in action before. I don't know if you're familiar with the Amazon Kindle. And the neat thing about the Kindle, and also the one laptop per child screen that was created by Mary Lou Jepson, is that these aren't like bright computer screens. They actually look like text on paper. And they're therefore easier to read from. Now, mind you, because of the technology, the text still has to be that big, so you're turning the page every 30 seconds. But, you know, that's the sort of thing that adjusts in time. So I think part of what you're observing is based on the primitive nature of the technology. It's kind of like criticizing the light bulb in the early years because, you know, light bulbs that would flicker, they were unreliable, the power went out, nobody could ever read using those. Real people waited for daylight.
You're suggesting there's a difference between print-based literacy schools, which are hundreds of years old, to a new literacy now, digital literacy. You're suggesting it's quite different.
Well, this is the second part, yeah. The part that's the same is we want this deep knowledge. And the only thing that's really preventing us is the technology. The part that's different is that I think deep knowledge itself is changing. I think deep knowledge, it's like the paradigm of deep knowledge that you've just described is reading something in depth. The paradigm of deep knowledge for somebody in the network age is playing Myst for 24 hours at a time, immersing themselves, you know, in like week-long Doom sessions, learning every single Starship configuration in EVE Online. EVE Online, they have battles between competing armies of hundreds of people with very complex starships, like really complex starships, and they're organized, they're working in three dimensions, and there's beyond, that's what I know of it, and I know there's layers and layers and layers further. That's depth of knowledge, but it's a different kind of depth, right? And so I think, you know, they may not read for long periods of time, but I mean, we look at what they do. They are definitely online for long periods of time and very intensively engaged, rather more intensively, I would say, than we ever were with the book.
Does that happen outside the military conflict paradigm?
The military conflict.
The military, you know, World Warcraft. I don't think we really want that providing our schools, to be honest.
That's fair enough. I speak from my own experiences. You wouldn't know to look at me, but I am not a pacifist. I play Civilization. I'm a pacifist in real life, but in my online life, I am very ruthless. And not altogether pleasant, but no, I'm kidding. There's a wide range of these environments that are not military-based. Some are zombie-based. No, I'm kidding.
I think we need to move on, right?
Well, let me just finish. SimCity, for example, you build a city, and you make a city work. You know, the whole line of sim products is very good in that way. It's not just military. There's a wide range of games and other immersive simulators. Flight simulators, classic example. People spend hours flying a 747 virtually. So.
Yeah, I can fly, but I just can't land.
Yeah, that turns out to be a trick, doesn't it?
effectively, what you're describing is an adult learning environment. How do we build the skills of young people to access that so they can use that as a constructivist approach to learning?
The short and somewhat flippant answer is they're already accessing it and we've been trying to stop them. The longer and more reasoned answer is that what we want them to do is to engage with these communities at an early age. To actually be a part of these communities so that they have, from a young age, models, examples, paradigms of quality behavior, quality production, I don't know what the noun would be in there, but you know what I mean? Models and metaphors to live by. And the other aspect is, you know, the gaming aspect, the simulation aspect, these are the sorts of things that we know draw them in, because we see them being drawn in. And in fact, we know these sorts of things draw them in rather more effectively than what we're normally using in order to teach them. Now the question is, how well can we teach them using these things that to draw them in? But I think that getting them into this environment, exposing them to practices in these environments will turn out to be as effective as attempting to teach them in other less attractive ways to them. Does that really respond to what you're saying?
Yeah, I think it goes towards what I'm saying. It's still a notion of if they're there, they will learn, and I'm not particularly sure that happens.
Well, I mean, everyone learns. Everyone learns all the time. You know, I mean, you can't not learn. Brains are learning things. So the question is not always, will they learn? We know that they will learn. They can't stop learning unless, you know, you shoot them or something. But that's the gamer in me talking. But the question, therefore, is not, will they learn? The question is, what will they learn? Right? And that's where these things, that's where these kind of concerns are always centered. They're always centered around, will they learn the right thing? Will they learn appropriately? Will they learn to separate truth from falsity? Will they learn to behave in a civilized manner and not beat people up, etc.? And I think these are very good questions. And I think these are questions that we ought to ask, you know, when we're looking at the design of our games and our online environments. And I don't think that we address them by avoiding this sort of reality. So, you know, I think that what they will learn depends crucially and pretty much entirely on what they are shown. And I think that we have to show them models of what we want them to learn rather than models of what we have been showing them so far.
I agree that the video gaming technology is something which could be used more positively in education, but my question is not related to that. Baroness Greenfield in the UK has done a lot of research, neuroscientist, in the way that this kind of learning is affecting the way that brains develop. Mm-hmm. Initially, there was a fairly positive response to this kind of use of the communication and the digital technology. But there's more evidence to say there is a lot of negative aspects to this kind of learning, the what, why, and the how, more the how than anything. Have you done any research into the longer-term effect of using these digital technologies on the brain development and therefore the learning of children? And we're talking about children here.
Mm-hmm. And I am not that kind of researcher. I don't go do brain studies on children. It's just way beyond my capacity. But I'd be curious to know, and I'm sure other people would be curious to know, what would constitute a negative effect in the scenario? What's an example of one of the negative effects that Baroness Greenfield has found?
This actually refers back to something that the lady down there has spoken about in terms of the ability to actually absorb information at a level that is other than quick grabs, but is actually changing the neural pathways of the brain in such a way that they can't fulfill certain functions. And her expression is that we're dumbing down and we're doing a disservice to our kids by relying on this technology to the extent that we think it should be relied upon.
Okay, now, I was pretty sure it was something like that. I haven't read her work, so I can't. But I figured it was probably something very similar to that. A big part of what I've been saying so far is that learning isn't about absorbing information. And so it should not be surprising, I would say, that learning by immersion, learning by network technologies is going to impact somebody's capacity to absorb information. The question is key here, the question that is key here is not whether or not that's happening. I can easily accept that that's happening. The question is whether or not that's a negative consequence. Let me reframe this. A big part of the problems that we have had in history have been that populations are all too willing and ready and able to simply absorb information. You know, we want people to be resistant to simply absorbing information. We want them to actively block information until they have decided for themselves that this is something that they accept, that this is something that they want to be. So, you know, it's one thing to say, you know, they're not doing this thing anymore, and this is a generic thing. Well, we'll see this across the board. We will see this over and over again. They don't do this anymore. They don't do that anymore. They don't perform trigonometry anymore. They don't use slide rule. I'm exaggerating a little for effect, and I probably shouldn't. But they're replacing this with other things.
That's not the point I'm trying to make.
Okay, well then what's the point you're trying to make?
Changing the structure of the brain.
Well, everything changes the structure of the brain.
Exactly, the neural pathway.
Your brains are changing structure right now. That's what it is to learn.
I mean, what she's saying is, well, what the research suggests is that when we rely on frontal cortex, because that's what screen activity does, we don't bring our declarative memory into being, and the declarative memory is concerned with prior knowledge, abstract experiences, creativity, precisely the things you're talking about, the things about critically evaluating, bringing it into my own experience and reflecting deeply. And I guess in the transactionary nature of frontal cortex activity, it tends to take away from what we might be doing in another activity. And I personally don't think that online learning is necessarily a binary to learning in other ways. I think that it's not either or. But there is an effect, and I guess we have to reflect on whether we're missing things in the piece and where we then need to develop complementary activities to offset where that might be and do the online learning and then take them into other learning to bring the other capacities more fully into being with what they learned in a very personal way. I guess that's how I've read some of the research and what my thinking's been about. I don't think it's either or, but we are seeing a shift.
Well, I'm not representing it as either or either.
That's good.
Okay. But, I mean, I'm trying to be clear on the other side of it, too, that these studies that say, oh, their brains are changing, or, oh, they're not doing deep learning, I'm not so willing to simply accept those studies as evidence that the learning that is being done online is necessarily inferior to learning that is done in other ways. I simply don't accept that. Now, we would have to sit down and analyze those studies. Like, first thing I would ask is, what kind of learning are they doing that they're just, you know, reacting rather than reflecting or deep thinking? Because, you know, the simple fact that it's on a screen isn't what creates that lack of deep awareness. I mean, that would be an absurd thing to say. It wouldn't make sense to say that. It's like saying, because it's on green paper rather than blue paper. So it has to be what is being done on the screen that is having this effect, rather than the fact that it's on the screen. So I'm concerned that it's being represented as, you know, this kind of learning, you know, changes people's brains, and we have to be really careful. Well, I just don't accept that criticism quite that uncritically, but I think we would have to go into that in more detail than we can at this moment.
We've probably got time for two more. Gentlemen in the front, one in the back, and we'll come back to you. Thank you for it.
I was just wondering what the name of that Baroness was, because it seems somewhat contrary to what I've learned.
Yeah.
What I've learned in the past about neuroscience and brain plasticity.
That's contrary to other researchers.
Yeah, I would be very interested to look at that, because that doesn't sound right to me.
What I was going to say is, I'm quite conflicted. I'm probably one of the younger people in the room. And I'm always self-confident, because what you're saying about how people use the online environment must be is how I learn these days. That's how I teach in self-improvement. Areas of interest, either work or personal pursuits. That tends to be how I learn these days.
Mm-hmm.
But I came from the traditional educational base, which wasn't how to do that. And I'm somewhat uncertain whether it's because I've learned from the traditional base, I can function effectively like this, or whether or not without that traditional base, other people could. What's your take on that? Do we need this traditional base, at least the, for instance, a structured learning in a shared communicative language before we can function in the new way of learning, as it were? Or is it something else that we can pick up without that?
Well, that's a good question. Because I mean, what you're alluding to is the very evident phenomenon that very many people are ill-equipped to manage their own learning. And so the question centers around what is it in your case, and presumably in other people's cases, that makes it possible for you to manage your own learning? Because probably you all manage your own learning. Probably most of all of your learning right now does not take place in university classes or anything like that. You're probably doing it on your own. And what was it in your background that made that the case? And we know it wasn't online learning, because if you're my age, when you were in high school and university, that wasn't an option. But I don't think it follows from that it was that traditional form of learning. And I refer to contemporary demographics, a large number of people aren't able to manage their own learning. Some people can, but many people can't. So, but where do I go from there? My thinking, you know, and just as a nod to the critics, I really want to be clear about this. I'm not saying I have the final answers on any of this stuff. That's so not what I want to be representing here, right? So, but my thinking is that because new technologies give people greater capacities to access information, to work with information, to grow and develop, than these same people would have had in the past, particularly those who would not have had access to any sort of a formal education at all, that these technologies, by that fact, will probably increase their capacity to be critical thinkers and reflectors. The simple access to learning that they couldn't have in the past will probably increase their capacities. Now, there's a second question over and above that is, will the techniques that rely on specific affordances of modern technology increase that even further? Can we go beyond even what we were capable of with a traditional classical education? That's a much tougher question. I think we can, and the reason why I think we can is that I think that what counts as knowledge in a classical traditional education is structurally deficient. I think that it was very good for an industrial age environment where we could explain the world or that part of the world that we interacted with in terms of simple general principles and cause and effect and things like that. But that kind of knowledge created and structured that way is not appropriate to a world of 7 billion people, incredibly complex financial systems, climate systems, social systems, and the rest, and that we will have to evolve new forms of knowing based on these new technologies, or more accurately, because it's not the technology, it's the affordances that are offered by these technologies. So that would be my approach and an answer to that.
You're suggesting that the difference is that we're connected now where we weren't in the past.
Mm-hmm.
Question back down there.
Stephen, I think it's important to remember that teaching is essentially a human operation and very much depends on or is embedded in relationships, the relationships of teachers and learners. I remember seeing in San Francisco once where an experiment had been set up with about 40 computers in a room, and a group of students had been set to use those computers in an online sense for the whole year.
we went round, I think, in month three, and I've never seen such a disengaged, bored group of young people. One of the young fellows I went past said to me, I wish somebody would talk to me. So I understand what you're saying, and I understand the flow of your argument. I think we never want to underestimate, though, the role of the teacher to embed the learning, to provide the paradigms, to provide the foundations, and indeed, more importantly, to provide the inspiration and the real person-to-person stimulus for going after information and skills and concepts and understandings and the online network you're talking about. So I'd like to bring the human aspect into focus around what you're saying.
I totally, 100% agree with the human. Not meaning you specifically. But I totally agree with what you said. In the sense that, it is part of being human to be in connection with and inspired, etc., by other humans. I think that's critical. And there's the whole range of things. And, we can multiply story and story that proves this. The Romanian infants that were raised by machines and that came out so deficient. I can go on, right? But, and you knew there was a but coming. I think that a critical weakness of the way we've done education in the past is to devolve this responsibility onto the teacher. What you're doing is you're taking something that really, in my view, ought to be a responsibility of an entire society, and having a small group of people responsible for this, and even worse, taking these children and putting them in separate rooms, segregating them into separate rooms, and then having all the human touch that they require, 20, 30, whatever, the responsibility of this one person. I think, and this is part of what new technologies enable us to do, I think that it becomes part of any job, any role, any profession, any specialization, not just to do, but also to teach. Not just to fulfill the function, but to show, to model, to demonstrate, to connect with the people who will be following along. And I think that we can do this now. We used classrooms because we had to. It was the only way to educate more than just the kids of rich people, right? It's the only way to educate the population as a whole. It's the only thing that would work. But now we don't need to rely on just one person. We can all take part in this a little bit.
Last question in the front.
Thank you. I was going to agree with the young man down the back because I was doing the same thing and looking around at the age of people. No disrespect, but do you anticipate that? I mean, there is an aging teaching population, and they are going to retire soon, and that there are these up and coming young people who, a lot of this stuff seems to be that more generational gap thing that. Technology will be fine to keep young people with the use of the digital technology. They're more open to trying things. What I'm hearing from people saying things aren't working because it is not something they're as open to.
Yeah, Thomas Kuhn, of course, who's famous for his book, The Structure of Scientific Revolutions, which is a theory about how science evolves by shifting from one paradigm to another paradigm. Normal science, and then as it becomes more and more unstable, you have a revolution, and then a whole new worldview comes and takes its place. And he says in this book that the old replaces the new, not because people are convinced, not because people are changed, but rather because people retire and eventually die off. And so there is an essential kind of lag that happens in any scientific revolution. Now, of course, no generalization is 100% true, and it is possible to change and jump into a new a new paradigm, although people like, you know, Mark Prensky and others say, well, you can't genuinely be a part of it. I'm sure it's not a function of age. I believe it's a function of background, upbringing, and exposure. So I think that would create the line more effectively. But is there such a line? Yeah, there is such a line. Not precisely along age, not precisely along demographics, fuzzy at the edges, but I think, yeah, there is a line. And I think that time will be the most effective implement instrument in moving from the traditional system to the new system.
Stephen, I think it's time that we wrap up. We're just about running out of time. I'm hearing you saying quite clearly that there's a marked shift in a connected world and information and communication, and that's throwing up a lot of challenges we need to think about in education. Absolutely. Can I ask the President of the Australian College of Education, Victoria Chapter, Carl Stevens, to thank you.
I think we've all been very engaged in a quite fascinating discussion presentation from you, Stephen, and it's really a tribute to you that a lot of people here, senior educators, in the first day of the school holidays or university holidays, are here to hear you, because your reputation is is quite widespread. And we can understand why your eminence as a philosopher is quite obvious in the way you've stimulated thought about learning, about technology, about society, and it's fantastic to have a good debate. It's always interesting and engaging to have a good debate, and quite clearly quite a number of views about the room. I'm glad to hear you saying it's not an either-or thing, but we are really understanding and pushing the boundaries of what it means to learn for people, and I don't know that it's really related to the age. You yourself, I think, probably not one of the younger members of the room, but you have probably what a lot of people here would think are fairly enlightened ideas about learning and how technology can contribute to learning styles and learning forms. So on behalf of the college, the Victorian branch of the College, Stephen, and particularly the people in the room here, thank you very much for a really interesting and stimulating talk and a discussion, and I'm really pleased that you're here to do that. So thank you very much. And also some other thanks, if you could bear with me for one more second. Thank you to Jerry White and Annette Rome, who are the co-presidents of the Melbourne region, and thank you to Annette and the Wesley Institute and Wesley College for hosting it here. Wesley is actually very good to the college and hosts a number of events here. Very grateful for that. I think we might have some refreshments afterwards. And just another plug, if you haven't already, perhaps decided that you might visit the digital fair, perhaps in keeping with the theme that we've started off tonight. The college is celebrating its 50th year of existence in Geelong next week, Geelong where it began, and that's being celebrated at Geelong Grammar with a digital fair. So there are still places available to go to that, and you can go just for a one-day registration. So perhaps you might like to think about doing that. All the details are on the website. So thank you, everyone, once again for coming, and enjoy. Thanks again.
I wasn't trying to leave.